What's good, y'all? For first-time listeners, welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock, and for those who've tuned in before, welcome back. I just want to let y'all know that during the recording of this episode, I ran into an unprecedented issue with my audio. When you listen to this episode, you'll hear a weird staticky noise in the background. My internet connection was doing some weird things, but nonetheless, my voice as well as my guest voice are still very much audible. Like I said, this was an unprecedented issue, and I want to apologize in advance. Thank you for understanding. Speaking of today's episode, after months of communication, this past November, we finally had the honor of interviewing Jamel Shabazz. Shabazz, a Brooklyn, New York native, is a renowned fashion, fine art, documentary, and street style photographer, as well as the author of Back in the Days, The Last Sunday in June, Seconds of My Life, Sights in the City, New York Street Photographs, Back in the Days Remix, and most recently, A Time Before Crack, photographs from the 1980s. Mr. Shabazz is a wealth of knowledge. In part one of this extensive interview, Shabazz talks about developing a love of photography from his father, as well as an unlikely neighborhood hero of his. He reflected on developing a sense of consciousness as a black man through photography, but also being lured into the streets before being enlightened by a mentor. In the wake of dropping out of high school, Shabazz enlisted in the Army, where he temporarily put the camera down and educated himself through music and literature while stationed in Europe. After completing his duty, he came back to Brooklyn in the early 1980s to a whole new world. Part two of this episode will be out next Monday, March 27th. I can't wait for y'all to hear it. Words matter. Welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock, a podcast dedicated to storytellers. I'm here with fashion, art, documentary, and street style photographer, as well as author of Back in the Days, The Last Sunday in June, Seconds of My Life, Sights in the City, New York Sights in the City, New York City, New York Street Photographs, Back in the Days Remix, most recently, A Time Before Crack, photographs from the 1980s, Jamel Shabazz.
Hey, peace, brother. Thank you again for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. Like I said before, I started recording. I don't know, you may not agree, but I definitely feel like you're a legend, and whoever will watch this and listen to this, I know they feel that you're a legend as well. I've been following your work for a long time, you know, on Instagram, and then I've seen a lot of your photographs for a while before I even knew they were yours. You know, and I, you know, it looked like very, very, and we're gonna get into this, but it looked very like Gordon Parks-esque, and I know that's one of your inspirations. So, you know, and you're able to capture a time period and, you know, embody a time period that a lot of people kind of try to like replicate almost in fashion and music a lot of times. So thank you for responding to the emails. It's been months in the making, but
it's so good. The timing is perfect, brother. Could not be a better time period than now. So I'm really honored to have an opportunity to exchange thoughts with another brother, you know, because my journey, everything I do is for your generation. So it's not about me. It's about having these different experiences and just sharing them with the younger generation, hopes that perhaps they could learn something from my experience.
Yeah, and I hope we're learning. I'm learning. I hope we're learning from your experience as well. So how are you?
I'm doing great, brother. I have no complaints. You know, despite everything that's going on, you know, it's been a very challenging year and even years. I've lost a lot of people within my circle. So I'm just striving now to maintain and better understand what my purpose in life is. Because since COVID hit in 2019, I've lost well over 80 people within my circle. Wow. And being that I photograph so many of them, I realize now that my photographs can really help people go through their grief. It can help to reinvigorate the spirit of a lot of people. So it has really helped me to further understand I have a greater purpose in life more now than ever before due to the fact that so many people have passed away. So I'm happy with this position, which I have. And I'm just really honored that this task has been given to me during these very challenging times.
Yeah. So, I mean, have you lost people to COVID and stuff?
I've lost people to a combination of things, yeah. Brother. You know what I mean? COVID, murder, suicide, cancer, you name it. It's been a combination of everything. You know, my partner just contacted me. I reached out to him, matter of fact, the other day just to check up on him. And he informed me that in a conversation that his daughter just got murdered. you know, and that was like 3 days ago, you know, so this is, it's a lot right now, you know, on so many different levels, like I said, suicide, you know, aging, but a lot of people who have passed away in my circle have pretty much been young. Yeah. You know, I'll say that, you know, young to me is pretty much 50 and under. Yeah. And it's just so many. It's very troubling, you know, when I turn on my computer and one of my photographs might appear making an announcement that someone else in my circle has passed away. So it's been a very troubling time.
Yeah.
But again, it motivates me to continue what I'm doing.
Yeah. No. So who are you?
I'm a student of life. You know, I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I see myself as a conscious brother trying to make a difference in this world. You know, I've been given a task to be, in a sense, a messenger, you know, and the camera has been my compass. So I'm just trying to be a light in a world that is full of so much darkness during this day and time. And I became aware of my assignment early on in life. So I'm looking at myself as a student. And at the same time, you know, a messenger, you know, and using the global language of photography to hopefully inspire people around the world to see love and light and have empathy towards each other.
Yeah. And, you know, your empathy is definitely a common theme in your work. And we'll get into that. You know, you picked up a camera at 15 and you began to document your peers after being influenced by Leonard Freed, James Van Der Zee, Gordon Parks, but were there any events or, you know, one event that took place that led you in the direction of photography?
Oh, no doubt about it. It happened in 1975 in Brooklyn, the East Flatbush Crown Heights section, where one of my rolling partners took me to the home of his cousin, who at that time was the warlord of a gang called the Badass Stompers, which is a division of a larger gang called the Jolly Stompers. And his cousin, you know, was this dynamic young brother, might have been about 2 to 3 years older than me, but I went to his apartment and there I was just amazed, first of all, that I'm there, that I'm with this legendary brother, you know, who held a key position within this organization. And what I found amazing about it was the photo albums that he had, because his cousin had already told me that he wanted me to see these pictures of this gang. And unlike the gangs that we are accustomed to seeing and hearing about, they wear colors or wear cut-off jeans with their names on it. This particular gang, the Jolly Stompers or the Badass Stompers, they were very unique. They were a combination of Caribbean, African-American young men that dressed very dapper. Mm-hmm. And they brought the two cultures together. They brought the culture from the Caribbean and England and they mixed it with the African-American culture. So you had the Kangos, the Spitfires, the Straddle Jackets, the British Walkers combined. So in terms of fashion, these young brothers were dapper. And I was blown away behind these images because I'm young and I looked up to a lot of these individuals. You know, they were, like I said, they were older than me. So when I looked at his photo albums, I saw these incredible black and white and color images of the gang, posed, dapper, serious looking brothers. And I mean, the photo albums were huge and page after page after page were these beautiful images. And it blew me away because prior I had a love for photography.
Yeah.
But mainly I was looking at documentary work or work of my father. I never saw images that really related to my generation. So when I saw these particular photographs, I was just blown away. Mm-hmm. And immediately, like I had an epiphany and I said, I want to be a photographer. So I remember leaving this home excited. And I went to my house and I snatched up my mother's 110. She had two basically cheap cameras that she just used to document house parties, a 126 Kodak Instamatic camera and a 110. And I would use both of those cameras when I returned to my junior high school and I started photographing my friends, you know, and I photographed them in a similar light as this brother Cornell did with the gang. And that started my love affair. It's like once I looked through that viewfinder and I took that first frame, I was immediately in love with photography. And I haven't stopped since. So the vision really came from this young brother that was a gang member to me. Yeah. Who he has some of the greatest photographers I've ever seen in my life. You know, nothing could ever top it. I tried to mirror it in a lot of the work in which I've done, but I wish, tragically, he passed away. But those albums would have been incredible. So I try to really reproduce. My work is like a reproduction of what he has done. And I still can't match it because it was phenomenal work. Wow. I've never seen anything like that before in my life. I caught the tail end of that culture. But what he captured, I think from 1971 to 75, was just unbelievable photographs. I have no idea what happened to those albums, I try to reach out to his family because I feel that that work is historic and it needs to be preserved. But nobody has any insight onto whatever happened to those albums. And Cornell was a photographer. You know, many times people look at me as being one of the ones that kind of like was on deck. But Cornell was there before me. And just unfortunately, he didn't get that light to showcase that work.
Yeah. I like that you brought that up, that he was in the gang and he was like a powerful figure in the gang. But at the same time, he had a creative element to him, because I feel like when people come to conclusions about like guys from the hood, they don't really talk about how, you know, they have different, they have a duality to them. You know, they have like a tough guy side to them, and they also have a creative side. They have an intellectual side. So, you know, I think that's the fact that you were influenced by someone from, you know, from the street, but in a creative way, is something that needs to be spoken about more.
Yes, that's why I make it a point to speak about that, because it changed my life. The gangs were very different back then. They were still violent, but they were different. So he had a great influence on my life, and another former gang member had an influence on my life as well around that same time. And he directed me in the area of knowledge itself and learning more about who I was. And he belonged to a gang called the Ex-Cons. And he was a young, troubled kid that went through the system, you know, juvenile detention. And during his time in Spofford, he transformed his life and came back to the same community he used to terrorize. And he started looking for brothers to give enlightenment to.
Yeah.
And I was in a really bad place at that time. So I'm very grateful that he intervened in my life and put me on the direction of consciousness. So a combination between growing into consciousness and picking up the camera really gave me the balance I needed to navigate myself as a 15-year-old kid.
So if he never gave you that that consciousness or influenced you, you think you would have went down the same path of, you know, being in a gang, being in the street?
There's a good chance I might have been dead, you know, because I was living in a very negative state of what I like to call triple darkness. You know, I was blind, deaf, and dumb. You know, my parents had divorced. You know, I started to go astray in school, you know, leaving private school and going into public school and kind of like had a love for knowledge. But once my parents divorced, there was no safety net to give me guidance.
Yeah.
So I fell victim to the streets. I dropped out of school and I was trying to find my way. You know, thankfully, you know, I went to the library and I educated myself, and I had my enlightener, Rommel, to kind of like put me in a direction. But I probably would have been dead, incarcerated, or an alcoholic, because there weren't a lot of options out there and there weren't a lot of role models out there at that time. And again, nobody saw that I had drifted off the path. Not only did I fall victim to the streets, but my partners did also. And when, as I went back and I analyzed it, the common denominator with all of us was our parents had divorced. Mm. And they were trying to navigate through their lives and they didn't have time for us. They just made the assumption that school would educate us, not realizing that we needed so much more than that, because the lure of the street was there.
Yeah.
You know, and it had a serious gravitational pull on a lot of us. So luckily for me, you know, I was able to move on, because I came from a graffiti background and a musical background. You know, my crew, you know, that I connected with when I moved from my projects of Red Hook to East Flatbush, all of us, for the most part, we picked up instruments. You know what I mean? Our parents at that time, you know, they saw the importance of instruments. So, you know, I played the bass. My other partners played drums. We had our little band going on. But it wasn't enough to keep us stimulated. Yeah. Many of us gravitate towards graffiti. Matter of fact, all of my partners were graffiti artists. You know, I saw it, you know, I saw the beauty in it at that time, but I needed to do something more. So that's when I picked up the camera and I was able to, that camera became my compass and put me on a better path. But definitely, if I didn't get any form of enlightenment, I would not be speaking to you right now, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a similar story that a lot of people have been through, but some weren't fortunate enough to have some guidance outside of their family, or, you know, someone to encourage them who, you know, they could relate to. So you say your father never, because I watched your documentary that's on Showtime that was directed by Fab Five Freddy, and you said that your father never understood your compassion, and he was almost disgusted by the photos you took of the social conditions around the city because he felt like you were wasting film. Why do you think he felt that way, and what do you think the disconnect was?
You know, I'm glad that you brought that up, because, you know, that particular documentary Charlie Ahern did to me, you know, I was very young and I was still trying to understand my voice at that time. I really can't look at it because in retrospect, I would have done things a lot differently and I would have said things a lot differently. I've since matured and I've learned to better understand my father and have an opportunity to revisit the letters that he wrote me when I was in the military, in addition to looking at his negatives and the various books that he read that influenced me. And I think that my father saw me as one that was very concerned at what was going on, you know, in the street. And I trained my lens towards a few things that he didn't quite understand. He didn't understand the snapshots of youth culture. And he didn't quite understand my interest in documenting prostitution and poverty and just the pains of society. And not that he didn't agree with it. He just didn't quite understand where I was coming from, you know, at that point. You know, so I don't say that he was disgusted with it. He was more trying to understand his son, because I just came home from the army at that point.
Yeah.
And I came home somewhat of a revolutionary to a degree. I was concerned what was going on within my community. And my father was very conservative in his thinking. And I was totally opposite of who he was. So, you know, I was grounded in just documenting the streets. So he didn't understand the snapshots that I was taking of a lot of my peers. For him, they were just snapshots. But he didn't realize that I was using my position to try to save a lot of these young men from the destruction that was going on in our community. I never explained to him that. So he would see these snapshots, which he called them, mm-hmm. and he was trying to groom me to be more of a documented street photographer. But I did that too. I followed his instructions, but I still gravitated towards the high schools and youth on the street. So he just saw those as just basic snapshots. And but when I look at my negatives now, you know, I listened to his instructions. He gave me some very clear instructions that allowed me to create an incredible body of work, because he told me to document the streets, document, you know, the cars, the street corners and things of that nature, use a wide angle lens. And I was a little, it was all right to me. I wanted to interact with people, but I did that. And when I look at that work now, it's an incredible body of work that I did under his instructions. I would bring the image, I would photograph, get the images printed, bring them, let him look at them. He would take a grease and he would highlight, you know, he would make the corrections that I needed to, you know, he would just observe some of the things I needed to just tighten up a little bit. But it made me a better photographer. Yeah. Those are some of my most important images. I actually found a number of those negatives not too long ago, and that work was exhibited in the Bronx Museum, being shown for the first time. And it's incredible work because most people know me for my street portraits. Yeah. But what my father taught me to do was use a wide angle lens, a 28 millimeter, and just document the streets, unposed images of just everyday life. And I got the buses, I got the trains, and it's all him. You know, so he never had an opportunity to really see the majority of my work because he passed away. But everything that he told me, it stayed with me, and it helped influence the man I am right now. So I'll say that as time progressed, before my father passed, he started looking at some of my key images, like the iconic photograph of the man swinging the dog and the kids flipping on the mattress. Yeah. That was his instruction, because he drilled in me the importance of light, composition, and speed, and understanding the technical aspects of photography. In addition to the fact that he spent a lot of time teaching me the developing process. I built a dark room in my laundry room, and that allowed me and my father to connect. And then he taught me the fine art of printmaking. So, like I said, as I had an opportunity to revisit the things I said in that film, I had to look at it from a more mature perspective. And I realized my father was basically just a hard teacher.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it was. And, you know, it was that tough love. So I'm very grateful for the foundation that my father gave me, because as I gotten older, I realized what he was trying to do for me, and I really got it. He put me on a serious path. And at the time in which I was coming into photography, I was just trying to find my own way. And having, you know, I was out of the country for 3 years. So when I came back, I wasn't accustomed to seeing the things I was seeing. So it was new to me, and I felt the need to document it in order to better understand it. And it's very valid because I had my vision. My father had his particular perspective of how he envisioned me as a photographer, but I had to find my own way. And as like I said, as I got older, I brought the two ideas together to formulate my particular foundation. So I'm very grateful for all of what my father gave me, because it really helped me to be the man I am today and the photographer in which I am today.
Mm-hmm. So with your dad, what branch of the military was your dad? He was in the Navy?
He was in the Navy in 1955, the same year that Emmett Till was lynched. He served on a ship that's now a museum, the USS Intrepid.
Yeah, right on the West Side Highway.
Yeah, so he was on that ship for a number of years, traveled throughout the Mediterranean, and for whatever reason, which is very rare, for a black man at that time to be 17 years old to be a photographer by trade. So he was trained at one of the fine schools, the Navy School of Photography in Florida. And he was good at what he did. So as a young child, I remember looking at his tour books that he would help create, you know, from his travels throughout the Mediterranean. So, you know, early on, you know, he had those albums in addition to his personal photographs. And I was always fascinated behind his travel. So through his photographs, I got a glimpse into his world as a young man.
Yeah. And you kind of followed in the same path because you went to the military and then you were already a photographer. I don't know if your dad was a photographer prior to him joining the service. But
My father, he, whatever reason, I don't think he was a photographer prior to going to the military. I don't know where that interest came from. I really don't. Perhaps it might have came from his uncles that also served in the military. And back then, many military men during the 1940s, they had cameras. The camera at that time is the equivalent to the cell phone today. Mm. A lot of these men knew they were going overseas, so they took cameras with them. So I was accustomed to seeing photographs of my grandfather and all of his brothers that served in World War II. So there's a chance that maybe my father saw that when he was younger and he understood the power of photography. You know, for myself, I took a different path. You know, whatever reason, you know, I was taking pictures from 1975 to up until the time I went into the military in 1977. For whatever reason, when I went in, I stopped shooting. I might have taken a few with a Polaroid camera. But one of the things my father didn't tell me, which would have been a game changer, and that would have been to say, yo, get yourself a camera, or I'm going to get you a camera and take that in the military with you and document every aspect of your journey. Unfortunately, he did not say that to me prior to going in, and he never really articulated that to me during my time in the military. Fortunate for me, you know, I would borrow my partner's cameras every now and then and create some images, but not like I could have done, you know, in retrospect. You know, so because I think that what happened to me during my time in the military, I gravitated more towards music and books. You know, I needed to educate myself. So I spent a lot of time in the library and I purchased a lot of books of consciousness. And at the same time, music was a big thing, you know, in the military back then. So once I got situated, I bought me a high power stereo system and I went on to just get into a lot of music. Because what's unique about that experience, you know, being in the military, which is a microcosm of society, you were in an environment with people from all over the country. You know, so with that experience, you're introduced to music from both the West Coast, from the South. So I got caught. I got introduced to a lot of music and I spent a lot of time making music during my time over there. And I put the photography down. I didn't really see the value of photographing my experience over there because I just, whatever reason, I didn't have that vision at that point. I have a few snapshots, but nothing major, you know, but once I came home, you know, I was just determined never to be without memory. And that's when I was on a mission. I came home with a camera, a Canon AE-1, and I want to document that experience. Because with my time in the military, all I want to do is do my time and get out. Yeah. And I wasn't really interested in anything other than that, than really trying to improve myself and complete my tour duty and come home with an honorable discharge.
Yeah, that makes sense because I haven't really seen a lot of photographs from that time period. So it does make sense that you weren't really into photography as much. What music were you playing?
Oh man, music was a little bit of everything. You know, back then Earth, Wind & Fire was popular, Parliament, Funkadelic. I mean, a little bit of everything. A lot of jazz. I got, you know, I knew jazz before I went in, but now, you know, because we had a post exchange, a PX, where you got your albums from. So anything that had a black or brown face on it, you bought regardless. So we didn't have a whole lot of it. So any album that came out, you know, with a person of color, I just purchased. So from there, like I said, I was introduced to jazz, R&B. Then I went downtown Germany and I was introduced to reggae music. So I got involved in a lot of reggae music. And at that time, Steel Pulse was the group, you know, and very political music at that time. So I embraced a lot of that. So my music is very vast. You know, because what we would do in making a reel-to-reel, because back in the days, the reel-to-reel was the thing. So if you're going to make a reel, okay, it's about a 4 or 5 hour tape. So I would go and borrow albums from a lot of my roommates, or should I say fellow soldiers, and get me stacks of albums in addition to mine. And I would go and I would just make me some reels with a wide range of music on it. But there was a lot. But the popular groups at that time, Gil Scott-Heron, Curtis Mayfield, Barry White, Confunction, Slave, a lot of the big bands back then. And then in the late 1970s, I was introduced to hip hop. And my first time hearing hip hop was in Germany. I mean, prior to, in terms of on vinyl, because prior to that, in 1975, we didn't call it hip hop. It was just rhyming. You know, when I first heard it growing up in Brooklyn, you know, cats would get on the mic. Another one would just be DJing or you know, spinning and just rhyming. You know, so it wasn't a name for it. It wasn't until I got over to Germany where I started to hear hip hop, because cats would be coming on from the Bronx, you know, returning from the Bronx to the base. And that's when I got turned on to, you know, to Curtis Blow, Grandmaster Flash, a lot of the music of that time period, a Spoonie G and so much. And I actually have that on a reel-to-reel to this very day. Positive Force out of Philadelphia. And that just changed everything for me. And I heard it, but that just inspired me to want to come home, because that music reminded me of New York. Yeah. And it was very rare music at that time, because hip-hop wasn't really that popular back then. But when Rappers of Light came out, it really caused an explosion over in Europe. And what people don't understand, how hip-hop really elevated overseas, is really due to military bases. Everywhere you had a military base, whether it be Germany, Korea, Japan, hip-hop had its presence over there due to American soldiers. They would play the music in the clubs, and people from the civilians would come, and they develop a love and appreciation for the culture. So you find in those countries that I mentioned, hip-hop is very popular, and it's largely due to American soldiers that were stationed over there. Nobody really speaks about that.
Yeah, and I always was interested about that. I'm glad you answered that, because I was always intrigued by the fact that in, like, Eastern Europe, they love hip-hop so much, and they love, like, the origins of hip-hop. They love graffiti, they love breakdancing, they, you know, they love, like, lyricists, where, and, you know, even artists that were successful in the States, that their popularity kind of waned a little bit in the States. They go overseas and tour and still able to be successful. So, but now that you broke it down like that, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it goes back to World War I, you know, when the black soldiers went over to Europe, particularly France, and they bought jazz. You know, so nobody really speaks about that, the influence that those African-American soldiers had back in the early 1900s to bring jazz over to Germany, you know, excuse me, throughout really Europe. So, yeah, you know, we played a great role in that. There really needs to be focused on more.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the military, I mean, why you dropped out of school, but why join the military?
Because it was really no other way at that point. You know, yeah. I was lost at that point, and we really needed mentorship in the street, and it wasn't there. You know, a lot of my partners, we all pretty much dropped out, and we were just trying to find our way, and the direction in which we were going, it wasn't really good, and I needed a better way. So luckily, you know, for me, there was a recruiter that came up to my high school. He saw us hanging out, and he approached me. He started building with me about the military and the benefits of joining and how you can continue your education and travel. So I realized that this was a good move. So I conferred, hooked up with my partner, Lamel, and we both decided that once we turned 17, we were going to enlist. At this time, we were 16 years old. But we knew at this point that we needed to get away from the streets. And the recruiter sold us a dream, and it really worked to a great degree, because we did get away. We went in the same time. On my 17th birthday, my mother signed me in, because you needed an adult to sign you. My father was in total disagreement with it. I never really understood that until I came home, but I just needed to get away, because, you know, the climate was really changing out there. You know, the streets started getting more violent. A lot of guys were getting locked up. And I just needed to find my way. And again, I had no real direction. So fortunately, that recruiter snatched me up. And I had uncles that was in the military. They was in Germany. And I decided that I needed to get away. So it's one of the best decisions I made at that time. Fortunately for me, the war in Vietnam had just ended a couple years earlier. So there was no war going on. And I didn't really understand the magnitude of what I was getting involved in. But I'm glad that I did. I had just turned 17 years old. And I was at a very... I was a deep stage in my life. So I needed that experience to get away and find myself.
If you were 17 years old now, would you still join? What branch were you in, by the way?
I was in the Army.
So if you were 17 years old right now, would you join the Army?
By no means. Yeah. Not at all. Emphatically, no. You know, because it's a very different time, and it wasn't really a great time back then. You know, and I don't agree with the wars that this government has embarked on. You know, that has contributed to the destruction of so much, you know, so not at all. You know, it's a rough decision sometimes when I've encouraged people a few years ago to go in because they were facing incarceration.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, and it was a very one of the most difficult decisions I've ever made in my life, where I was mentoring a young man that was faced with prison. And I had no other choice in terms of saving him, but getting him in the military and guiding him every step of the way, saying, look, you know, I'm going to hook you up with a good MOS, you know, but you're not going to go into combat. You're going to go in the reserves. So it's going to give you an opportunity to go away to basic training, advanced individual training, and build the foundation for yourself. And there's a good chance you may not go to war. But it was a very difficult decision because I could not see this young man go to prison. So yeah. I had to guide him in that direction. And he went in, and I guided him every step of the way, from writing him letters, going to his graduation, being there to help him navigate through that, because I didn't want to lose him. And luckily, he survived that. But I would not go in today. You know, I would find other ways, but it's not the way right now.
Mm-hmm. You became pro-black, like more pro-black after you did your time in the military. Prior to joining the service, were you as pro-black?
I'm not going to call it pro-black. I grew into a consciousness of who I was.
Yeah.
I think what happened during my time coming of age, which really was transformative throughout America, January of 1977, the miniseries Roots came on television. Mm. And it caused a transformation almost overnight.
Yeah.
You know, we got a glimpse of the African, the transatlantic slave trade for the very first time, because we weren't being taught this in school. So that created a situation where I wanted to learn a lot more about myself and where we came from. But prior to that, when I was 15, you know, like I said, I met a young brother that stressed to me that we are not niggas. You know what I mean? That we come from greatness. And we have to learn about ourselves and where we come from. And we need to eat the right food so we can navigate through the challenges of life and avoid diabetes and high blood pressure. And our history is not, it did not start on the plantation. You know, so at that stage, I started to learn. And I think what caused the transformations for me as well is when I picked up the autobiography of Malcolm X at a very young age. And I saw that the struggle that a young Malcolm went through in his life. And then I was exposed to racism in America. And also through the book Black and White America by Leonard Freed. At 9 years old, I read this book. So not only was I looking at the photographs that dealt with segregation and Jim Crow and racism, you know, I was it's the images that opened me up. I'm looking for the signs for the very first time, whites only. So at 9 years old, I started to understand that I'm growing up in a world that's really against me. And through photographs, I started to see racism. So my consciousness developed at about 9 years old through photography, because at that stage, I fell in love with photography books, and I was always studying them, and I was seeing racism in these books. So I think through the visual language of photography, I grew into a greater consciousness, knowing the type of world I'm living in. Because mind you now, I'm a child of the 1960s, so I'm growing up during the civil rights movement, and a lot of that had impact on me. Seeing those images that the great photographer Ernest Withers did of racism in America, seeing black men holding up signs, I am a man, looking at the attack dogs that the police are sicking on black people. I saw these images and I realized that this is the world that I'm embracing. So I start to want to know more about that world. And that's what drew me to look into books. And everywhere I went to, the library became an oasis for me. You know, even when I was in high school, I would cut my class and go to the library and pick up books that really fed my consciousness. That's all I wanted to know. So I did that throughout my life. It was only enhanced in the military because now I got an opportunity to travel and connect with other people, you know, throughout America. I'm having conversations with Klansmen. I'm having conversations with Black Panthers. I'm having conversations with cats that was in Vietnam about the experience. And I'm seeing things from a more broader lens. And that strengthened my consciousness because it was certain things I wasn't aware of until I went into the military. It became more apparent to me the different things that went on. I wanted to understand the Vietnam War more from those that fought it because it was fresh. Yeah. And why did this war exist? I wanted to understand the COINTELPRO. And then through artists such as Gil Scott-Heron and Curtis Mayfield and Steel Pulse, through their music, they start to inform me of different things that was going on that I didn't know. So my consciousness was intensified during my time in the military because I spent a lot of time, like I said, between reading and listening to provocative, or should I say protest music.
Yeah. It makes sense. What are some of the professions that kids, because you felt like, you know, there wasn't much for you to do after you dropped out of school and you and your friends dropped out of school. But what are some of the professions that kids of color in Brooklyn were encouraged to pursue in the 60s and 70s?
I think, you know, we had a love for music. So a lot of brothers within my circle were DJ, you know, they were good at what they did. Music was a really big thing for us. So, you know, DJing was one, musicians was another thing. And there's other illegal activities that individuals looked upon as professions, which I'm not going to get involved in. But it wasn't a lot at that point, to be honest with you. You know, it just wasn't when I think about it. And nobody really explained anything to me at that point. You know, our parents were trying to figure out their way. And yeah. Even my aunts and uncles were going through a divorce. So nobody really stood and explained anything to us. I think that what happened with a lot of my family members that served in the military, many of them went into civil service. So they were working for transit, the post office, and different positions of that nature. I wasn't even thinking about that at that point. You know, yeah. we didn't have no clear vision, anything. I think that when I went into the military, my mother was a nurse. So when I went in, I wanted to be a medic. And that was my key. And my strategy was, if I can go into the military as a medic, when I came home, I could get into the nursing profession, which is something I wanted to do. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. You know, I ended up going into infantry because I didn't know any better. But at the same time, that still benefited me.
Yeah. Yeah, I listened to an interview a while ago with Charlie Murphy, and he was talking about how in New York City, during that time, 70s, 80s, you were only really encouraged to get like a civil service job or get a city job. And that's why he like protected Eddie so much, because he was the one who made it in a way that was so unconventional. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense what you're saying with the kinds of career paths you guys were encouraged to go in the direction of. So you come home from the Army and you're a CO now, you're a corrections officer.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I came home from the Army in 1980.
Okay.
You know, so I didn't become an officer until 3 years later.
Okay.
So I came home from the Army, and it's very important that I say this here. I came home to a war. A very interesting war that I wasn't expecting. You know, I was expecting to return back to a similar society that I left. Again, being inspired by Roots and this whole conscious movement was taking place now. A lot of people changed their names. They started wearing an African garment. The music was positive. It was a spirit of love during the 70s, you know, that particular time period. But I came home and everything changed. And now a lot of young men were dying at the hands of other young men. A number of my friends who I grew up with, they had lost their brothers to violence. These young brothers I knew personally. So I came home, they were dying. I had partners of mine that stayed. You know, when I went in the military, they stayed, and I'm coming home only to find out that they had been shot, you know, and a number of them had been shot. And they were engaging in these foolish wars that were going on within the community. There's a lot of hatred that was going on, unbeknownst to me. Because I came home and I was a conscious brother before I went in. So I knew a lot of people. But when I came home, you know, I still knew a number of people, but they were at war with other people, which I knew. And nobody really knows how deep this thing was. Even with the cover of this book right here, this is a really powerful photograph, because this young brother lived around the corner from me, Carroll. And Carroll was a good brother to me. He was younger than me. He used to be on my block all the time, and I would engage him in conversation. And I saw him just as a good brother. I had no idea what was happening with him a few months earlier. The fact that he was at war with other brothers I knew personally. And every time they saw each other, they were shooting at each other. Mm. And I knew all these brothers that were enemies of one another, and I couldn't believe it. And it became very painful to me, because it was always talk of revenge, retaliation. And I had a number of friends that were at war with each other and didn't know it. It's like, my house is interesting. When I came home, a lot of people would come visit me because they knew I was back in the world. And I didn't know all of what was going on in that time, that all these wars were going on, like the fact that Carol had beef with these brothers that would visit me later on in the day.
Yeah.
And just a few months earlier, they were shooting at each other. And every time they saw each other, they would shoot at each other. He had so much respect for me, Carol, that he would not open up on these dudes. And I didn't know that that beef was gone because they all went to school with each other. And when the next short window of time I was born, they became enemies of each other. Arch enemies, where they would have killed each other on sight. But due to me, they didn't do it. So I'm looking at all this and I'm baffled. I'm angry because I'm coming home expecting to come back to a world where we are brothers. But instead, we are divided and there's hatred going on. And I know all the people that war with each other. And I'm engaged in all of them, not realizing they're at war with my other partners. So I realized that I have to shift gears and I have to deliver a message to reach these young brothers to speak about the importance of brotherly love. And that's where the photography comes in, because the camera allowed me to approach a lot of brothers and take the picture, but more importantly, to engage them first to find out what's going on. And I often reference Marvin Gaye's song, What's Happening, Brother, about a brother coming home from the war. He wants to know what's going on. That's me. I want to know what's going on. And then when they start to break down and me what was going on, I would take that picture as evidence of the conversation. But I still didn't know what was going on and how bad it was until years later. You know, when I started to share my photographs, I realized that a lot of brothers have beef with each other. Now I'm looking at cats, they got their Pumas on, Adidas, they got Kangos, they look like they could all be brothers.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are divided. And we had this division from territories. So you have brothers from the 90s that beef with brothers from the 50s, brothers from the 50s have beef with brothers from the 40s. All this beef was going on. And a lot of these cats went to school with each other. So something happened bad in the ear. And I had to get out there in the street and use my position to engage young brothers and let them know, y'all, I just got back from the military. What's going on out here? You know, we got to have brotherly love. Because one thing that I got from my time in the service, I got a chance to see what brotherly love looks like. Because back then, every brother was a brother for the most part. Because there wasn't a lot of us there. So you saw a brother, it was about brotherhood. You know what I mean? You might see a brother in the street, in the military, and you take your right hand and put it to your heart and say, how's the brother? It meant something. So I came home with that spirit. And everywhere I went, there was just division. So I was just trying to use my platform to engage people about what was happening. So I came home to that point. And thinking about, and one of the things my father told me, all right, you have to apply for all the city positions out there. So I applied for a wide range of city jobs, from transit, the post office, corrections. And then 2 years later, the correction department would hire me and I would go through that process. And I viewed that as an important assignment that I needed to go on to try to find out what's happening in society. Prior to me becoming a correctional officer, one of the first jobs I got, I worked at a men's shelter, you know, as a security officer. And that is because I was going to school, navigating school and just trying to have me a part-time job. And it's there that I saw poverty and homelessness and mental illness for the first time. And I met a homeless correctional officer, as a matter of fact, who might have was going through a bad divorce. And he saw how I conducted myself. And he told me, you'll make a good correctional officer. We need people like you in correction. And this was a homeless brother who might have been in the war, who was just going through a hard time. So I decided that that's the position I need to take. So in 1983, you know, I became a correctional officer working in one of the worst jails in the country, ARDC, better known as C-74.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to, into your time in Rikers, but, you know, I got the book too. Yes, sir, you show the book. So you said this brother right here, he was at war. You know, you just looked at him as like a good brother. Why choose this picture of him as the cover and why not other pictures?
That's a really great question that you would say that, you know, and a lot of people ask me that same question too, because some people don't like him and they didn't really care for that cover. For me, it represents the brother that kind of like I let loose. I was not able to get him. You know what I mean? We used to build a lot on the corner of my block. He was a good brother. I kind of just wished I spent more time with him because he got murdered a few years later and he lived right around the corner from me. And if I knew that he was that type of person, I would invested a lot more time in him, you know, to bring him to my home, to build with him, to find out what was going on in his life. He never showed me that side. You know, he showed me a really good side, but I had no idea he was a gangster that he was. So, you know, I had a lot of love for that brother. He's in a few of my photographs. And it's something because I didn't photograph him a lot because I spent more time talking to him. You know what I mean? So there's times I would see him on the block and I have my camera. We just built it.
He's just your friend.
You know what I mean? About life. Say it again.
He's just your friend.
We were becoming friends, like my little brother. So he's one I couldn't save. So that photograph would be the very last time I would see him, you know. So, you know, to me, he was just a good dude, and I just had a lot of respect for him. And it's just something about that picture. What's unique about it too is that that picture has become one of my most iconic images, and it's bittersweet. Some people like it, some people don't like it. But his son, who looks just like him, just earlier this year, I was able to give him a copy of that photograph to let him know that I honor your father. Despite his flaws, he was still a good brother to me. So to me, that picture represents my neighborhood. It's taken on Flatbush Avenue. That was the style of a lot of brothers back then. And he just represented a lot of young brothers that I would gravitate towards. You know, for me, going after those kind of like thorough brothers is what I needed, because I would go to them and say, yo, I need your help to save our people. You know what I mean? You are a brother with great influence. You know, you have that power. And collectively, we can go out there and try to make our communities a better place. Yeah. So he represents so many other brothers that I met similar that could have graced the cover of my book as well, because they're pretty much similar stories.
Yeah. I'm going to grab this book, and for all the people that are listening and not watching, I'm showing the cover of his book. And I want to get into like what he's wearing. What exactly is he wearing?
Well, he's wearing a tailor-made two-piece suit, which was very popular back in the days, you know, especially amongst those from the Caribbean. Carol happened to be Caribbean-based. I believe his family came from Grenada. You know, he's wearing his clocks, which is very popular back then. That whole style is a Caribbean style. That's not really American style at all. Even the poles.
That pole is very Caribbean.
Pole. That's why I call it Rude Boy, because that was a traditional Caribbean type of poles. So he pretty much epitomized that style. You know, the part, you know, was very popular back in the days. The jewelry was coming up, you know, for a lot of these young brothers. And, you know, straight leg pants is kind of popular, because back in the 70s, the pants that we wore for the most part were flared.
Yeah.
So it was it was that influence of Caribbean culture, mainly coming out of England, that, you know, again, the clocks, the British walkers, the straight legs became kind of like the fashion of those that lived in the middle. Because my neighborhood, East Flatbush, was Caribbean, African-American. Mm-hmm. So they mixed the two cultures to produce a particular style. So he pretty much represents the Caribbean look of a lot of the Rude Boys back then.
Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of people that don't know that, you know, Caribbean culture, Jamaican culture is one of the most influential cultures in New York City and in the surrounding areas. So, you know, my parents are from Jamaica. I feel like I had to say that. So,
all right.
And they came. And by the time you came from Germany, that's when my mom migrated to New York. So,
wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, you know, when I see these images, it just kind of like just sparks my creativity, my imagination of her like commuting to work, commuting to school during that time period on the train, you know. So, it just puts me in a place that I, even though I've never been there, I just kind of feel like I have an idea. So, you know, let's go back into your time on C-74 on Rikers Island. You brought a camera into the facility?
I did. You know, my father told me to carry your camera everywhere you go. So looking at what I didn't do when I was in the military, I decided that this is an experience that I want to document throughout my entire 20 years. So before I even got to the facility, when I was being investigated for the job, I bought my camera and I documented the whole investigation process, the medical, the psychological, the physical. When I was in the academy, you know, for the 8 weeks, I documented every aspect of that experience, everything. Once I got to the facility, my camera was with me and I kept it on the down low. You know, I didn't really reveal it openly, but I would document my coworkers in the locker room. And then on particular tours, I might bring it into the housing area and document my partners. Then once I start to see a lot of the brothers I knew from the street, you know, I start to document them. So it wasn't like I was just documenting anybody and everybody. It took time for me to just do that. And I built up a massive body of work, first with my coworkers and even with the brass, you know, the supervisors, because at that time, nobody was really photographing anybody. So it was really unique for me to come in and even see the value of photographing people in uniform in a jail setting. So once I gained the trust of my coworkers and the supervisors, they pretty much left me alone. And it's not that the camera was ever revealed. It was always concealed in my bag, but I always kept it with me because I felt that this is a very important part of my journey that needs to be documented. And I started to document especially when I had a steady housing area, where now I'm going to a particular area every day. And I have a relationship with these young men who are under my custody, and they allow me to photograph them.
Was bringing a camera encouraged, you know, especially by higher ups?
By no means. I mean, it was illegal. Wasn't encouraged at all. I mean, if certain supervisors heard about it, it would have been a problem. Whatever reason, throughout my 20 years, I brought it in, and it was always concealed.
Yeah.
But my supervisors was me. You know, these are people I knew, you know, and people, everyone can appreciate a good photograph. And nobody really denied that, you know. And I look at the strategy in which I've implemented, and it was a really good strategy because I started with a lot of the brass, the supervisors, and they might have been sharp in the uniform. I photographed them. I gave them a copy free. I never asked for any money from anybody. So I would give people pictures for free, and they value that. So that helped to build the trust. And then I would just do my little side thing. Nobody really knew I was taking pictures inside the housing areas of the inmates. It's one thing to photograph your coworkers, but no one even really thought about going and documenting the other side. But I felt the need to do it because, again, I knew a lot of these young men, you know, so they gave it to me. And some of them I knew from the street. I had already photographed them from the street. So the signs I would even bring in the pictures I took of them, and I would give it to them. Yeah. So that furthered the trust, you know, and it was a very important body of work because it serves as a visual diary of my experience right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, later you published those photos. Did you get any like negative reactions to you posting these, you know, publishing these?
I didn't really publish a lot of them. You know, very few that I published, and the majority that were published, you really couldn't see the faces of people. You know, so it wasn't really like an issue. I've been retired now for almost 20 years. Mm. You know, so a lot of time has passed. A lot of people have died. What's very interesting now is a lot of the young men who I photographed who are incarcerated are reaching out to me. And they appreciate the fact that I photographed them when they were probably 16 or 17 years old. Many of these men did 20 to 30 years in prison. Mm. You know, so I have reestablished a relationship with them on social media, and now they're helping to tell that story. So, you know, I'm very careful in what I put out there because I don't want to hurt anybody, because I will not want to put a photograph of someone and all of a sudden his girl finds out he was incarcerated.
Ooh,
so I'm very select in terms of what it is I do. I focus more on people who have passed away, you know, because a number of the brothers I photographed that was incarcerated, sadly, they were murdered when they came back to the world. Mm. So their families appreciate the fact that I've captured them in a way that nobody has really done before. Because it's one thing to have a photograph of a person in the street. It's another thing to show a photograph of a person in his cell and what his cell surrounding looks like. So there's been never no flack behind it because I do it with integrity, and I don't do it with the intentions of exploiting anybody. Yeah. I use it as an opportunity to illuminate what the conditions of jail look like. Because when you look at my jail pictures, if I don't tell you that they're in jail, you would never know. Because back then, people wore civilian clothes. You know, so everybody had civilian clothes on. They got jewelry. They got gazelles. You really can't tell because you're not even really seeing bars.
Yeah.
So I could post a bunch of jail pictures up right now and nobody even know unless you were there because the way it looks. Now, it's different today because people are wearing uniforms with DOC on it. But back then, you know, where I worked at in 74, everyone wore civilian clothes. So you would never be able to tell unless I make that clear.
Yeah. Was it ever conflicting being a corrections officer, knowing that, you know, many feel like you're working for an oppressive regime and probably working in knowing corrupt officers, especially for someone like you who has a deep empathy and compassion for their people?
It's mixed emotions about that, you know, because when we look at the Attica Rebellion in the 1970s, you know, one of the demands that the prisoners made during that time was they wanted more correction officers of color because they were dealing with a system that was traditionally racist, and a lot of officers were racist and were brutalizing them, which led to the Attica Rebellion and so many other rebellions that took place throughout this country. So that was one of the demands. They wanted more officers of color. You know, so when I took the position, you know, it was a job with a lot of black people on that job, you know, because we were able to handle it because a lot of those cats came from our community and they welcomed you. I mean, it's a very negative, violent, hateful atmosphere. But those brothers who are incarcerated that know you, they are happy to see you because of the fact that you will have that empathy towards them, where others have got no connection to you.
True.
Nothing. You mean nothing to them. So they can go in there and just hate you. So if you got a young brother, and I have a lot of them that I will find out looked at me as a mentor. You know, they start to kind of like mirror me. And they had somebody like a big brother that they needed to help give them the guidance and direction which they need. Because as a correction officer, you're in a position to give people employment. You can help them in a lot of ways to deal with the frustrations of incarceration. One of the things I try to do with those that were under me was give them jobs. So now you got a job, so you don't have to be confined to a housing area. So there's a lot of people that welcome it. And there's others on the outside that may not understood your position. You know, as far as they concerned, you was an enemy of the state, but they didn't understand your role. Because I recently got into a debate with this individual that really attacked me for taking on that position. But you didn't know what my assignment was.
Yeah.
You had no idea what my assignment in life was. I went in with an intention to save lives, both inmate, the inmate population and officers, because we were pretty much one and the same, trying to navigate through the challenges of life, badge or not. You know, so I was striving to be a light. And I think that, you know, for many years, I didn't really speak about that. And now I speak more about that experience, because it's one thing to look at my work and make this assumption I was just a photographer, but you need to understand, people need to understand that I spent one of my main motivations for hitting the streets in the manner in which I did, because I'm leaving Rikers Island. I'm leaving a very negative, violent, hateful atmosphere where dudes are getting robbed, they get stabbed, some can't take it, they try to kill themselves. So I was coming home from the job, going into the streets of downtown Brooklyn, Flatbush, Red Hook, trying to take my experience from that job to hopefully encourage young people that, yo, you got to be careful of the pitfalls of the street. We have a war on Black people, a war on drugs is going on, and people are falling for the bait. You know, when that crack cocaine came out, the money was so good, a lot of young brothers and sisters gravitated towards using it and selling it, and they were falling victim to the system. And that was the trap, because we understand the disparities between cocaine and crack cocaine, and a lot of people fell victim to it. So for me, I would leave that job and go into the streets and use my position, my experience, my camera as an opportunity to engage people about who I was and what I was just seeing. And I was encouraging a lot of young brothers to say, yo, the only way to go to jail is as an officer. You know, get up in there on the job. You can make a difference. You have a job. And at the same time, you could use your position to give these young brothers encouragement. Because this is very painful to go to work every day and see so many broken Black men and women in there.
Yeah.
It hurt me. It's, you know what I mean? Because that's what you're dealing with. So, you know, I went in there very clear on what I wanted to do. And I was saving lives every single day. Every day I went to work, I look for people in which I could snatch up and give guidance to. You know, I would carry the newspaper with me, read the material, books that I wasn't reading anymore, trying to encourage people to read and elevate themselves and say, yo, you in here. It's like a 15-round fight. You might have got knocked out the first few rounds, but you got to keep getting up and fighting. You know what I mean? I'm encouraging them to look at the life of Malcolm X and how he was incarcerated and the transformation that he went through towards his incarceration. Martin Luther King was incarcerated. Mandela was incarcerated. A lot of great people were incarcerated. So it wasn't the end of the world. I understood political prisons, but I also understand the importance of atonement, that maybe you might have made a bad decision in life, but this is a chance to atone and move on with your life and get going. You know, so I tried to be a light, and occasionally there was some degree of opposition from those that didn't quite understand me. But in the majority of cases, a lot of people did respect me, and that's why I was able to build up a large body of work on the street, because a lot of the former inmates would see me on the street, and they knew me to be a decent person, they would allow me to photograph them. I don't really talk about that a lot, but a number of people I photographed, especially downtown Brooklyn, I knew a lot of them from the jail. And they did time, and they might have even been exonerated, and they were back on the street again.
Yeah. No, thank you for going into that. Because, you know, when I found out you were a corrections officer, I'm sure there are some people out there who have, who don't have context to you or, you know, your empathy, who may feel like that might be like a point of contention about your, you know, your past or whatever. But, you know, thank you for breaking that down.
Yeah, and it's important that I share that too, because people really don't know who we are, like what we look like. If I was to show people photographs of correction officers, both on duty and off duty, they would be shocked. Even a number of brothers I photographed back in the days with gazelles on sheepskins, British walkers, they got on the job because there weren't a lot of options back then. Corrections was paying really good.
Yeah.
It's something because I spoke to a sister who told me, she said, back then we didn't have a lot of options. It was two options for the most part. You become a correction officer or you became a drug dealer. And I thought that was like really deep. that that's how it was viewed at that time. So a lot of young people got on the job. We was in our early 20s. The mantra at that point was, in terms of employment, was hired in my 20s, retired in my 40s. So where else could you get a job where you can make good money, have great medical benefits, come on in, at 20, retire at 40 years and get a pension for the rest of your life? And it's a very different corrections than it is now. Because back in the 1980s, a lot of the older correction officers were Vietnam veterans. So they were more mature. And we look at Rikers Island as a mess today. Back then, it was a lot of violence as well, but it was more controlled. And they had more programs that were trying to elevate people. And the inmate population felt a little bit more protected.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm on a mission right now to help people understand better who correction officers were, because they came from the community. You know what I mean? We just have this assumption that they're white racists and they are brutal. But a lot of us, you know, we've had family members that was incarcerated. So we had that empathy. Practically every correction officer I know has a family member that was incarcerated at some point in his life, both black and white. So nobody really knows who we are. It's just this bad image that has been given in us. But that's why these conversations are important, for you to better understand exactly where we came from. You know, and many of us got on them jobs to try to provide foundations for our children so they don't have to go out of that route. Many correctionals were able to send their kids to college. They were first-time home buyers. They used that position to elevate. And many, especially from the community, they came in there with an empathetic heart. They weren't trying to be brutal, because we had to come back to the community.
Yeah.
Especially someone like me, I couldn't be that way. You know what I mean? Because I'm leaving the job, I'm going back in the neighborhood, and it's easy for somebody to want to kill you now because of that position. And there were situations that people just looked at me as the enemy, because they may not have had direct contact with me. You might have only seen me on that job and boxed me in like everybody else, not realizing that I'm there to be a light. You know, and I'm here on a mission to try to save as many as I can. And that's what I did. Like I said, every day I went to work trying to save people. And I would snatch up a lot of brothers, bring them into my area, make sure they got a phone call, and just try to get them whatever guidance I could, because that's a very negative atmosphere to be in, you know? Yeah. And that's why a lot of dudes, they kill themselves, because they feel there's no hope. And sometimes you're shut down, you're brutalized. So that officer, that conscious officer, could make a big difference. So I pride myself in trying in saving the lives of a lot of young men.